Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Sanders and Trump won huge in New Hampshire. Hillary says Bernie's making promises he can't keep and that he's criticized Barack Obama too much. A complaint Bernie says is a low blow. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Margie O'Meara, a Democratic pollster with Purple Strategies. Welcome to all of you. So the winners in New Hampshire were expected, but the margins of victory perhaps weren't. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both winning by about 20 points, Sanders by a little bit more than that, actually. And there was high turnout, especially on the Republican side. We're going to take a broad look at how that happened and what's next. But I want to start with a big question for the Democratic pollster we have with us, which is, when you poll Democrats, you find they really like Obamacare, they really like the president, they have favorable views of Hillary Clinton. The polls do not show a sort of dissatisfaction among Democrats with the way establishment Democrats have been performing over the last 8 years. So why is this so hard for Hillary? Shouldn't a continuity campaign basically saying Obama was good, let's do more of that, be an easy sell to this Democratic electorate?
Well, I think there are a few things, particularly if you look at the New Hampshire exit polls. Primary voters are actually divided between wanting a candidate who will continue Obama's policies and one who will go a little further, who wants the president to go further and have a more liberal take on Obama's legacy. So I think they begin divided in that regard. I think also you see a lot of Democratic primary voters in conflict between the detail and nuance offered by Hillary Clinton and expertise and mastery and the vision and clarity of message from Bernie Sanders. And I think you see voters really grappling with that.
Bob, what do you make of this? Is there a conflict between feeling really good about the Obama presidency and embracing this sort of radical critique saying that we need a political revolution in America?
Well, first of all, I think we have to recognize there's great unhappiness in this country, and it's across the board, and it's across racial divides, ethnic and political. For most people in this country, the economy is not working well and has not been working for some decades. And that's summarized by the income inequality thing. But no, it's also the amount paid for jobs. It's a feeling of insecurity and so forth. And so you have really establishment candidates that think things are pretty good. And then you have a large number of people in both parties who think they're not good. On the Republican side, they respond to a demagogue like Trump who tells them it's all the fault of the immigrants coming from Mexico or something and demonizing others in that way and getting off the hook as a billionaire himself. And on the Democratic side, you have Hillary Clinton, who I think is really minimizing this whole issue and certainly not taking any responsibility for her own policies for it, and saying, oh, well, Wall Street is just one street, and there's all sorts of issues in inequality and so forth. What the voters in New Hampshire and earlier in Iowa, but particularly New Hampshire, younger people, and as someone who teaches at college, I can tell you the feeling is quite widespread. Young people don't feel it's working well. They're very worried about their future. This issue of student loans is only a symbol of that, that the good times are not about to roll. And I think Hillary Clinton is tone deaf on that. I also think she's a warmonger, frankly. If you look at her record and then you look at what Kerry's doing now, you have a contrast of two secretaries of state, one who is busily making peace all over the world. And when Hillary was in, we were still doing, as Bernie points out, regime change and overthrowing secular dictators and replacing them with fanatics competing for power. So I don't think Hillary has the political outlook that at least the base of the Democratic Party does.
Rich, it's funny to watch this debate on the Democratic side in comparison with the way Republicans talk about President Obama, because the idea from Republicans is basically that President Obama has been disastrously changing the country for the worse. Indeed, that's the thing that Marco Rubio could not stop himself from saying over and over in Saturday's debate, that the president is setting out to radically change America. And so you compare that to the conversation on the left, where the question is basically, has Obama really achieved much of note, or do we need drastically more change than we've had? It seems like somebody has to be wrong in their diagnosis there. Either the Obama presidency has been important or it hasn't.
I think the liberal critics are wrong, because the big things that President Obama set out to do, unfortunately, almost all of them he's done. And there has been a big shift to the left in a whole host of areas and domestic policy. But I think the problem Hillary has is she really seems to have a two-pronged case against Bernie Sanders. One is that she represents the Obama status quo. Yes, she wants to go a little further, but she basically is identifying herself with that status quo. And that's not very exciting for anyone, and it's not contradictory to appreciate what President Obama has done from the left, but want to go much further the way Bernie Sanders does. And the other is the case she was making in the debate this week that Bernie's program is implausible. And I, of course, agree and think it's highly implausible, but that's not terribly inspiring at all. And he has the much clearer, much more inspiring message. You see it with the astonishing numbers among young people. And now it's just a question whether she can grind it out and hold on among moderate Democrats and among minority voters. But I'm just not sure the attempt to depict Bernie Sanders as this nasty attack dog against the country's first African-American president is really going to work.
I want to play just a little sound from the debate last night, the fighting over exactly this issue between Hillary and Bernie.
Today, Senator Sanders said that President Obama failed the presidential leadership test. And this is not the first time that he has criticized President Obama. In the past, he's called him weak. He's called him a disappointment. He wrote a foreword for a book that basically argued voters should have buyer's remorse when it comes to President Obama's leadership and legacy. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves for being a president who got us out of that ditch, and it is the kind of criticism that we've heard from Senator Sanders about our president, I expect from Republicans. I do not expect from someone running for the Democratic nomination to succeed President
Obama. Madam Secretary, that is a low blow.
Margie, does this line of attack work?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I think it's tough to put Sanders in the same box as Republicans in terms of the attacks on the president. I don't think that's going to be very credible with a lot of voters who see what Republicans have done and said about the president to just be so far beyond what swing voters and independents and the most of the electorate wants the conversation to go. That said, the president's incredibly popular. I mean, the division that I cited earlier aside in terms of maintaining the president's legacy or going beyond, that division aside, he's enormously popular. So if it gets sticky, if this attack on Sanders gets sticky, that could be damaging because, the president is beloved. People on the Democratic side feel he's had a raw deal here in Washington rather than be the architect of a raw deal. He's, been handed a raw deal by Congress that's completely dysfunctional. So I don't know. I mean, sometimes I get the feeling also that a variety of people disappoints Bernie Sanders, and maybe that's where some of this language is coming from. So I don't know if it'll be sticky, and that's something that we're going to see in the days and weeks ahead.
Bob? I don't know what in the world that means. A variety of people disappoint Bernie Sanders. A variety of people disappoint Hillary Clinton, and I'm sure they disappoint everyone on the show. But I think what Bernie Sanders has certainly demonstrated is he can work with a lot of people. That's why he caucused with the Democrats. He has been quite supportive of the things that Obama has done, including health care, and he goes part of the way, which is what any legislator should do. The attack on Bernie Sanders agendas on that blurb was dishonest. It was profoundly dishonest. It clearly had been researched. He was prepared to do it. He did not write the foreword to that book. That's a lie.
This is the Bill Press
it's
book.
It's Bill Press's book, and what he did was give the kind of blurb on the back that you give. First of all, Bill Press is a highly respected Democrat from California. A lot of people know him and respect him, and he wrote a book raising questions about the success of the Obama administration, and that's what journalists should do. It's what anyone should do. Bill Press is hardly some wild guy out there. He was talking about his own disappointment, and the blurb simply talked about the need for pressure from the public on any government official to get progress. It was a quite innocuous blurb. And to pluck that out, and you know, clearly on the key points of Obama's campaign, Bernie Sanders has supported him in the good things. And it should be pointed out, by the way, that he made a telling point. You know, here's Hillary Clinton saying, well, I'm the first woman and there's woman majority and this is a real test. And then she has her surrogate saying any woman who dares criticize him, she's go to hell and so forth. Well, after all, when she was running against the first non-white to be running for office, she ran against him. She, you know, we want to talk about historic moment. She's the one that tried to trip him up in this truly historic moment. And so how dare Hillary now say, you know, I was always with Obama when, in fact, he was her opponent. And they argued about basic things. And I think looking at the record of this administration, by the way, I think that on foreign policy, Obama's policy has gotten far better with the departure of Hillary Clinton. And if you read these emails and you look at the discussion inside the administration, she was to the right of Obama on foreign policy. She's much more hawkish. And I suspect Bernie Sanders is much closer to his position.
And Marjorie, I want to ask you quickly about that demographic question, because there's this sense that part of the reason that Hillary's stepping up this line about supporting the president is that we're going into South Carolina, where a majority of the electorate will be African-American. And the idea is essentially that she'll run on, you know, you don't attack the first black president. And I guess people refer to South Carolina as Hillary Clinton's water firewall. Do we have a sense yet of how solid her support is with African-American voters and whether it's really true, this thing that gets said in the press, that Sanders is just inevitably going to run much better with white people than with non-white people?
So we don't know yet. As we were sitting down to record this, a poll came out in Nevada, but I don't think there's been a poll out yet in South Carolina since well before the Iowa caucuses. So we just simply don't know, because the Iowa and New Hampshire contests are going to scramble everything. In addition to that, you have a variety of African-American leaders coming out in support for Clinton, but also for Sanders, new advertising, endorsements, and so on. So I think there's going to be a lot of movement in the, you know, couple weeks ahead on that front. I also think that when we're talking about, you know, African-American voters, I think people are quick to go to this shortcut. Well, that's the reason to say to hug Obama, because that's going to work in South Carolina with African-American voters. Two things are true. One, it works with all Democratic voters. He's beloved with Democratic voters. Democratic primary voters support the president. They voted for him in 2012. Many of them obviously voted for him in 2008. In the primary. So he's very popular across the board. And also, secondly, African-American voters in South Carolina and elsewhere are going to care about a variety of things other than simply name-checking the president. And this is good advice for and good thoughts for both sides. So whether that means talking about education segregation, housing segregation, criminal justice reform, income inequality, a variety of issues, you know, racial tensions more broadly, police brutality, all of these issues are going to be important in the African-American community. Frankly, they should be and are important to a lot of voters outside the African-American community. And so if there's going to be more attention to all of those issues, that can only be a good thing for everybody.
Well, let us know what you think about the state of the presidential race at kcrw.com/LRC, on our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on that. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times and MSNBC. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Margie O'Mara of Purple Strategies is also with us. So this huge upheaval in the presidential race and this huge support for anti-establishment candidates came out of New Hampshire. All of this discontent with the status quo coming from New Hampshire. And there's something weird about this, which is that New Hampshire has unemployment of just slightly above 3%. New Hampshire has relatively low income inequality, has relatively high levels of education. It seems like if there's a part of the country where people should feel like things are going more or less all right now, New Hampshire ought to be an example of that. And yes, and yet people there seem especially dissatisfied with the status quo on both sides of the aisle. Rich, I was wondering if you have a sense of why voters are so upset there and how to make sense of the fact that things really are getting better and yet people seem to be only getting angrier.
Well, just New Hampshire has a taste for mavericks, certainly on the Republican side. Pat Buchanan won New Hampshire in 1996. John McCain, running against the establishment candidate that year, George W. Bush in 2000, won New Hampshire in a smashing victory. But pivoting to Trump here, when you look at McCain's exit polls in 2000, you could see a demonstrable weakness because he didn't do nearly as well among Republicans as he did among independents and didn't do nearly as well among conservatives as he did with the rest of the electorate in New Hampshire, which was a sign of the opening that Bush had to dismantle him in South Carolina. What is a little portentous for those of us who aren't eager to see a Trump nomination is Trump's support was pretty much across the board, all ideological groups. He did about as good with Republicans as he did with independents. And if you just blocked out the names and just looked at the level of support, you would look at Trump's across the ideological spectrum support from Republicans, very conservative, somewhat conservatives, and moderates, and say that's the guy who's likely to be the nominee. And he's just kind of scrambled the Republican, typical Republican coalitions, because he's dividing it much more on class lines. So that's why it's possible to see him, if he really gets loose after South Carolina, winning in a state like Mississippi and also winning in a state like Massachusetts, because there are a lot of working class voters in both.
Can we talk about Marco Rubio for a second? Who was supposed to stop that phenomenon that Rich is talking about there? And Rubio had this sort of odd implosion. I'm not going to play the clip. We've all heard over and over Rubio saying again, you know, President Obama knows exactly what he's doing. Margie, why do you think that mistake was? Well, first of all, do you think that mistake was as fatal as the media has made it out to be? Was that a key thing undermining Rubio? And if so, why did it matter so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think the polls suggested that that actually mattered. I mean, he was doing quite well, but there weren't that many polls taken after that debate, so it didn't really capture the average, didn't capture his decline at the last minute there, and he didn't do as well with folks who made up their mind in the last day or two. So I think it made a little bit of a difference at the margin. I think also you just had a more competitive race for second and third there than maybe you did in Iowa, so that was, I think, another factor. I think it made a difference because with a lot of these things, it's not any one gaffe or moment. It's whether or not it reinforces a narrative. And there is a narrative out there. There is a message out there that one could grab onto, that Rubio is too green or not ready for prime time, or, you know, I mean, even, you know, Cruz is very, I think, blunt and crass about this when he says he's, you know, has a pretty face, right? I think that he's trying to get at the same thing, which is, you know, Rubio it has attractive message. His messaging is quite strong and appealing, but does that really parlay into the gravitas that one needs for the job? And so I think that moment, that robotic moment, really kind of played into that narrative about him.
One thing that struck me this week is that it seems like a lot of this criticism of Rubio for going back to the same comfortable talking points for him could also be thrown at Bernie Sanders, who seems to find a way to make so many of his debate answers about Wall Street and the billionaire class and about fixing income inequality as a root thing for fixing all sorts of problems in society. On foreign policy, he has this tendency to go back to talking about the Iraq war vote, which is an issue where he was right and Hillary Clinton was wrong. But it's not a substitute for a sort of broader worldview of what to do in specific places like Afghanistan. And Bob, do you think that's a fair criticism?
No,
because it's one that that Hillary's put out.
I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's fair when she said it. I don't think it's fair when you say it. And I didn't think it was fair when the person who represented the left last week said it. In fact, let me quote what she said. I thought that Senator Sanders, this is supposed to be coming from the left, Senator Sanders' answers on Afghanistan and North Korea and Iraq were borderline disqualifying. And then she said he looks shaky, he looks shady, he doesn't look in control. There is a serious left critique, peace movement critique, and actually the Pope on the other side of things would also embrace it, and which is that the whole notion of regime change, of being the cop for the world, of this making people's history for them, backfires, there's blowback, and that's a very strong position. The vote on Iraq was not a minor vote. It was a vote to destabilize the entire region, and the consequence of that vote was madness. And for one thing, here's Hillary Clinton still suspicious of Iran, and we can't do this. She's actually to the right of Kerry on Iran, if you follow it closely. On the other hand, how did Iran's influence get expanded in the Mideast, if not overthrowing a Sunni secular dictator, Saddam Hussein, and putting in people who were living in exile in Iran? So Bernie Sanders was not making some last-minute stupid thought. He was representing a serious critique of American foreign policy that plenty of people have made, and I think has turned out to be correct. To dare to say that any woman who there's a special place in hell for a woman who would support Bernie Sanders. Well, the women of New Hampshire said nonsense. A majority of women, not just young women, overwhelmingly young women, but a majority of women in New Hampshire said that's nonsense. They don't believe in these wars. They don't believe in this foreign policy. And I think you should recognize maybe the center has shifted. Maybe the political dialogue, you know, and I want to make one final point. Everybody throws this word, the democratic socialist, as if it's some very weird, wild thing. Most of the industrialized world is run by social democrats, whether they call them that or not. They all believe in a mixed economy. They all believe in a strong safety net. And if you look at Bernie Sanders' trajectory, he comes out of a group called YPSL, Young People's Socialist League. It was actually a quite conservative movement in terms of foreign policy, everything else. It was pro-AFL-CIO. That's when he was at the University of Chicago. And really what he represents has been the dominant view in Europe. He is not some fringe candidate. And I think that he's providing a great education lesson for this public that, you know, socialism, democratic socialism is not a dirty concept.
Rich, I think one of the reasons that this Rubio thing was so damaging was not just how voters perceived it, but how big Republican donors saw it. They watched that moment and they saw somebody who they thought would melt in a debate against Hillary Clinton in November. And I was wondering, do you think that's right? Do you worry that the empty suit critique against Rubio is true, that he doesn't have a deep grounding that leads him to be able to defend his positions? And is that a good reason to worry about him as the choice to coalesce around?
Well, first of all, let me stick up for scripted politicians for a minute, because if you step on a debate stage not having a clear idea what you're going to say about almost everything, you're kind of an idiot. And everyone does have a really clear idea of what they're going to say, with the exception of Donald Trump. And the rules are different for him. But even he just returns to home base over and over again on, you know, five key lines or points about building walls and whatnot. But the Rubio moment was so devastating because exactly the point you're getting at, Josh. And it might be that this could be an exaggeration, but if you snip those 3 minutes out of the debate, history would have been entirely different, because otherwise he was completely fine. His answers were superb. And that Saturday afternoon, rival campaigns had Rubio surging within shooting distance of Donald Trump in New Hampshire. One campaign aide from another campaign told me, I think Marco Rubio is going to win New Hampshire. And he wasn't spinning. He really legitimately thought it. But it was a horrible moment. They had told him to elevate himself and not get in a mud fight with Chris Christie. Sorry. And that's what he tried to do. He did it completely ineffectually. He couldn't read the moment. Christie could be spontaneous in that moment. Rubio didn't. Couldn't be, and it really creates potentially an indelible impression about him, because you don't know if when the lights are shining most intensely and it's the biggest moment in a general election, if he'll freeze up or clutch in the same sort of way. So it was very damaging. I think you can overcome it, but it was no doubt a big moment.
Have you started thinking about what you're going to do if Trump is the nominee? I mean, National Review has struck out this extremely strong anti-Trump position. If he's the Republican candidate, are you guys going to have to be supporting him?
Well, our test is right most plausible, and in a contest against Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, just a two-person race, he would probably meet that test, and we would be in opposition to some extent in the Republican Party to a greater degree than has been the case in a very long time. We've had other nominees that we've opposed win the nomination, Bob Dole in 1996, John McCain in 2008, but this would be an entirely different kind of phenomenon. Obviously.
Well, but I mean, it's one thing to have a nominee that is not as conservative as you would like. But if you, I mean, it seems to me like you guys have concerns about temperament and judgment with Donald Trump. John Podoritz made I thought, a strong point about how Trump contributes to the coarsening of the culture and basically makes people meaner. Those things aren't different from just a matter of a position on the ideological spectrum. You would prefer the candidate.
They definitely are. I mean, we would have serious misgivings about him, but I imagine, I can't speak for our editorial board until we actually get to that point and sit down and discuss it, but I imagine we would think Trump would be better than Hillary.
Wow. Okay. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Margie O'Meara, what's on your mind?
So what's on my mind is the polling skeptics. So I read and talk and study a lot about polling as a pollster. And coming out of Iowa, the fact that of the top five candidates, the polls had shown two switched in their order seemed to portend a giant polling disaster that people were wringing their hands over for a couple days. In New Hampshire, there was no polling misstep. I mean, the forecasts were completely correct. There was no mea culpa. There was no, sorry, we doubted the pollsters after the fact. But I think the lesson here is usually the polls are right. Occasionally they've been wrong. And I think folks going into this election who want to look at every poll as more likely wrong than not are going to have trouble making it all the way to November.
Bob, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is that we shouldn't take the black community for granted, and the black community, the brown community, have been hit harder by this housing meltdown that was basically resulted from Clinton's ending regulation of the financial industry. And as a result, if you look at the Federal Reserve study from St. Louis, black college graduates lost 70% of their wealth. Latino college graduates lost 60%. So when the so-called Black Caucus PAC, which has 11 of its 20 people, are lobbyists, one of them for Walmart that doesn't pay decent wages, and they come out and say, oh, this whole vote has to go automatically to Hillary Clinton, I wonder what community do they really care about? Is it Wall Street, or is it the people really hurting in South Carolina?
Rich Lowry.
The rush to open all combat positions to women has been taken to the next logical step with very serious proposals to sign up women for the Selective Service for a prospective draft, as if no one cares that the Marine Corps has extensively studied this issue and concluded that mixed gender units are much less effective, which when you're talking about combat, you think would matter.
So the whole political establishment has been surprised by Donald Trump. Even I, when he announced in June, thought the candidacy was a joke. There's a reason we shouldn't have been so surprised, and it's in Arizona. You remember Jan Brewer, the governor who signed that Papers, Please bill about immigrants, the governor who waved her finger at President Obama on the tarmac? You may not know that she also really angered elements of the conservative establishment by raising the sales tax, by accepting the Medicaid expansion. Jan Brewer showed that Republican voters were more concerned about illegal immigration than they were about size of government, and that you could get away with so-called apostasies on taxes and spending so long as you hit the base where they care about it on immigration and on their hatred for the president. It should have been forewarning that the Trump-style campaign could work. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Margie O'Meara. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.